Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening. I'm Barbara Lane. Welcome to Good Lit at the Commonwealth Club and this evening's program with Toure. The program is co-sponsored by InForum, the Commonwealth Club's division for people in their 20s and 30s. Interviewing Toure tonight is the San Francisco Chronicle's pop culture critic, Peter Hartlaub. Please join me in welcoming Peter Hartlaub and Toure.
Thank you, Barbara. Toure was born in Boston in 1971. He left college to become an intern at Rolling Stone, where he was fired after a few months. But he returned to write reviews in some of the magazine's most memorable features in recent years, including Eminem, 50 Cent, and the first profile of Dale Earnhardt Jr., where he talked at length about his father's death. Toure's latest book, Never Drank the Kool-Aid, includes all those stories, plus Toure articles that he wrote for The Village Voice, Playboy, Tennis Magazine, and a few unpublished essays. Toure has to be about the only journalist who has played basketball with Prince during a story. That 1998 interview for Icon Magazine is a type of memorable encounter that Toure has become known for. He also played high-stakes poker with Jay-Z in this book and crosses angry record label owner Suge Knight. Most journalists who walk into an interview have already decided what their angle is, and Toure lets the circumstances shape the story. Kool-Aid is impressive because it features Toure writing in whatever style fits the occasion, and as a result, each piece is a unique and true experience. Toure is one of the best interviewers out there, which has served him well on MTV, CNN, and his current gig on BET. He's written two other books, The Portable Promised Land and Soul City, and I'm pleased to present Toure.
Thanks, man. That was so nice.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. I understand you've got a passage you're going
to
read.
Yeah, I just wanted to read a little thing just to give you a little taste of it. And the piece that I want to read sort of figures out or just crystallizes something that I figured out in my journalism career. I mean, at the beginning, I was very much like, the writer should never appear in the story. There shouldn't even be the word I, you know, because a lot of, like, writers will be like, so I landed in Houston at 3 o'clock, and I drove to my hotel, and it has nothing to do with Mike Jones, but you're talking about your life. And then after a while, I started to look at Hunter Thompson and Dream Hampton and some of the other writers around, and I said, there is a way for the writer to become part of the story and enhance the story. And this Kanye West piece, I'm going to read just the two scenes that work together, and I think this scene really wouldn't have had the same impact if I hadn't wanted to get right in the middle of it and affect the moment that I was in. The piece begins with Kanye getting dressed for like an hour. I mean, really, like 60 minutes. He finally emerges from the bedroom in a Ralph Lauren sweater with a huge teddy bear on it, paper denim and cloth jeans, and New Balance sneakers. Ralph Lauren is his second favorite brand, and you know who his favorite is because of his brown Louis Vuitton buffalo leather jacket, the Vuitton card holder in his pocket, and the classic Vuitton monogram duffel by his side at all times. But the center of today's outfit is the Jesus piece West picked up yesterday from Jacob the Jeweler, perhaps the top custom jewelry man in all of hip-hop. About the size of a grown man's palm, it has a cluster of clear diamonds for the crown of thorns, a river of yellow and light brown diamonds making up Jesus' blonde hair, aquamarines for his blue eyes, and little rubies for the tears of blood on his face. It's an ornate rendering, a $25,000 piece, and he's very proud of it. This is so fabulous, it could be in the Rob Report, he says. This is the same time that he had Jesus Walks on the radio, which he says in the song that he thinks Jesus is black. So I say, it doesn't bother you to sport a blonde-haired, blue-eyed Jesus? Only thing that bothers me is how other people are going to react to it, he says. But don't you think Jesus was black? Yes, I believe Jesus was black. When I saw it, I said, I don't particularly want to wear this as far as what I represent, even though I love it. But I do think it's a beautiful piece of artwork. We had a whole day of meetings and stuff planned. He, like 10 minutes later, he got on the phone and was like, cancel all that shit. We're going to Jacob's right now. So an hour later, we're at Jacob's. Jacob Arabo has a small office at the corner of 47th and 6th Avenue in Manhattan with a wall of photos of him and everyone in hip-hop who's made a little money. He's got that classy, ready-to-bend-over-backwards air of a luxury goods salesman. "I wanted to know if you could pop out these blue eyes," Wes says. "Sure," Jacob says reassuringly. "Change the eyes to what color? Do you have brownish-orange diamonds?" Jacob yells out to his assistant, "Go in the safe and bring me all the colored stones." "I actually like the way it looks with the blue eyes," Wes says, "but I'll get too much flack for it. I can't explain that blue-eyed shit. I need to do another one, a black one, because I have socially conscious lyrics, and I'm going to get flack. This really is the blonde-haired, blue-eyed Jesus." Jacob pops out the blue stones, but Wes discovers that no other colored stone looks good. So even though the blue eyes bother him politically, they go back in. Can he live with the blue-eyed Jesus on his chest? Can he handle the inevitable flack? "I got to get my explanation together," he says as he leaves Jacob's. 20 minutes later, he's got his little defense. "I'll say it's the one off my grandmother's wall. It's a eureka moment. It's grandma's Jesus." So then we go throughout our little day together. And then at the end of the day, we go to a college where he's going to perform. And his boss, Jay-Z, is there. It's minutes to midnight in the parking lot of Little Keene University in Union, New Jersey, amidst affordable Hondas and Volkswagens. There's a hulking tour bus devoted to West, and there's a Maybach, which is right now the ultimate hip-hop ride. The super luxury vehicle cost $350,000, and only 600 were sold last year. The Miracle Whip is owned by Jay-Z, but chances are his chauffeur is the only one who's driven it. Wes signed with Rockefeller in 2002 and developed a close relationship with his boss. "I still look up to Jay like a father figure," Wes says. "You know how Jewish families show their sons how to make money and keep the wealth going in the family? Jay's like my Jewish father." Wes hops out of the tour bus, zips over to one of the Maybachs, and climbs into the front seat. Jay's lounging in the back in a blue Rock-A-Wear jacket, crisp Rock-A-Wear jeans, and sneakers so white he's probably never worn them before. Beside him is a sexy woman in a short skirt and fabulous Pucci boots. There's an assortment of Dentine packs in the console and Andre 3000's The Love Below on the sound system. Jay-Z has this air of confidence so towering that if you've got even a speck of insecurity, it'll come out. Surely Wes knows this, but he's got a new toy that he's excited about. He takes the Jesus piece from around his neck and hands it to Jay for inspection. At first, Jay's impressed with the exquisite craftsmanship. Then a reporter says, "Don't it look funny to you that Mr. Jesus walks as Jesus is white?" And with that, Jay's whole mood changes. His eyebrows lower and skepticism comes over his face. "That is a little different," Jay says, no longer impressed. "Nah," Wes argues, "that's Grandma's Jesus." It's his first time testing the excuse. Jay's completely unmoved. "You gotta darken that face up, man." And the sexy woman chimes in, "And get rid of them blue eyes. He's a little too blonde hair, blue eyes, or tuck him in." Wes says, "We tried to get rid of the blue eyes." He knew this would happen. The blue eyes look best. "Yeah," Jay says. "That's what they make you think." Then he blurts out a laugh at the young rapper's expense. Wes tries to explain further, but Jay's heard enough. "Yo, man, we got a friend of ours party to go to. What time you get on stage? Can't take them niggas off stage." They all say, "It's tough love at the Rock." And as I was saying, I don't think that moment would have really mattered if I hadn't been, you know, able to be like, "Jay, that's whack." And then he sort of went with me. So.
Well, I think I'm glad you read that, because I think one thing that people may not understand is this is a collection of essays, and you think, well, it's a collection of things he wrote for various magazines and he was a hired gun. But it's really, I found it to be a really personal book.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, there's a lot of light moments in there. There's moments of admiration.
Mm-hmm.
And it's bookended by two very sad moments. I mean, Biggie Smalls, the death of Biggie Smalls, and at the end, the death of Jam Master Jay. I kept thinking as I was reading it, the Jay-Z line, "Can't leave rap alone, the game needs me." I mean, you're in this position where, you know, you're almost an ambassador, and it's hard for you, and I'm sure there are funny moments and hard, and light moments, but also difficulties too. And I'm wondering, you know, reading these pieces and going back, you know, can you talk to me a little bit about hip hop and where you fit in it and how you keep going?
Oh man, well, I mean, you know, I go back from the first day. I mean, I remember being in the car with my mom and my sister, and Rapper's Delight came on the radio, you know, and I was like, oh, what is this? Oh, my God, this is so great. Like, yeah. What did they do? And, you know, I think that was the only time I ever heard it on the radio, but it totally captivated me. And, you know, I've really been loving hip-hop since that moment and really just enveloped in it. I can't get away from it. And, you know, I love it, and then I get mad at it, you know, but I never, like, leave it alone, you know. And I think I care about the music and the way these people are portrayed. When I was an intern at Rolling Stone, I would look at the way a lot of writers would approach hip-hop, and white and black, I felt both of them undersold hip-hop and its complexity and its importance. And even the intelligence of some of these individuals, you know, they present themselves in a certain way, and it's very tempting and easy to think they're stupid. Mm-hmm. But they're not stupid. Some of them are. But most of them are not stupid. And if you approach them as if they're complex individuals and they're smart, then you can get that from them.
Well, that, I mean, the title, Never Drank the Kool-Aid, I think that that applies.
It's kind of a challenge to the other writers.
Yeah. Yeah. Talk to me about hip-hop writing and when you started, what it was like and what it's like now.
Well, it's changed a lot because when I started, the discussion of does hip-hop belong? Does hip-hop deserve this sort of serious coverage? The first story I wrote for the New York Times was about Snoop Dogg, and it was just a job just to convince the editor that Snoop was valuable and worthy of 1,000 words in the Sunday New York Times. And this was a month. And you know, as a writer, every day I called this guy like, yo, Snoop, oh, my God, it's a stylistic innovation. Because, I mean, Snoop was doing something different. The New York guys were really rhyming in a very hard, vocally hard way. And Snoop brought a vocal lightness to it. He was almost much more like a singer, much more like somebody who's light on their feet, you know, but vocally sounding. But it was a month of talking to this man every day and you know, just getting him to know what I think about hip-hop, getting him to know that Snoop is a really important person who will be around for a while. He's not a flash in the pan.
And at the same time, you're trying to convince Snoop's people to...
Well, that wasn't hard. Yeah. That part was much easier. Mm-hmm. But now, at that point, just the media that would cover hip-hop was relatively small. Mm-hmm. I remember I wanted to do Snoop for Rolling Stone, but they understood his importance. They gave him to their number one feature writer then. So then I went to Details, and they were like, no, we're not interested. And I went to Spin, and they were like, no, Snoop, no, we're not interested. Mm-hmm. So now, though, the number of magazines that exist, you know, the number of outlets that exist. I mean, we talked about hip-hop on CNN, you know? I mean, like, I did, like, a record review on CNN one day, you know, and I remember, like, this is bizarre. Like, the audience is like, what is going on right now?
It's been a relatively short amount of time, too, hasn't it? I mean...
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, this book comprises 10 years, so I think in 10 years, you went from having 3 or 4 mediums that would take hip-hop seriously to lots of them.
Take me back. You started to talk about it. There's a nice part in the book where you talk about a record store.
Yeah.
And being young and, you know, how that kind of got you.
Well, yeah, I mean, like, I was really fortunate. My father has had a tax accounting office in Mattapan Square, which was kind of centrally located in the black community in Boston. Mm-hmm. And he was on the corner, and then 2 doors down was Skippy White's record shop, which was not even as big as this room here. And there was this great guy with a long beard who looked like Rick Rubin, who knew my dad. And I was just a little kid, you know, 10, 11,
Rick
12.
Rick Rubin looks kind of like a biker for anybody.
Yeah.
If you saw him on the street.
Yeah, you know. Yeah, little imposing biker, long beard. Yeah. But the guy was really nice, and he allowed me this great policy that, you know, I could take a tape, because all cassettes then, and if I didn't like it, I could bring it back.
Yeah.
So this gave me total freedom to try all these artists that I'd never heard of. Mm-hmm. You know, because I was 11, 12, I wasn't listening to...
It's like 80, 81?
Yeah, 81, 82, 83, mm-hmm. yeah. So, I mean, there was no hip-hop radio. So as a kid in Boston living in the suburbs, just finding the stuff was hard. Yo, MTV Raps didn't start till like 84, you know. So, I mean, it was just... MTV wasn't playing hip-hop at that point at all, you know. So, but this guy allowed me access, allowed me to try these songs, try these cassettes without me having a financial worry for my little 12-year-old budget. So that allowed me to sample and see what was going on and learn about the different groups that were there. And at that point, you could have every hip-hop album that they had in the store. Now that would be financially impossible.
Yeah, it was like two or three...
Yeah, a month.
A month.
Yeah,
coming out back then.
Yeah, I mean, and I could go in the store and go, okay, got it. I don't like that. Got it. Okay, let me try that new one.
Was there an album or a point that you can remember where maybe you thought, this is more than, you know, something that I think's cool and I want to spend my money on as a hobby? Like maybe this is something I want to do. Mm-hmm. Maybe this is more of a movement, artistic movement, than just something I'm doing to spend my money on for fun.
No, I don't remember that sort of eureka moment. I mean, I know when I turned from just loving it to vocation was after college. In college, I started a newspaper. It was called The Fire This Time. It was very nationalistic, a little angry, you know, all editorials, you know, all about the black community at school, you know, and that college nationalism thing, you know. And coming out of college, I was like, well, nobody's going to let me write about politics. I'm 22, you know. But within hip-hop, writing about hip-hop, I could get into sociology. I could get into politics. So that's why I wanted to go into it. But as a child, it was just the lifeblood. I mean, it was the only thing. I mean, you know, I'd sit around and listen to R&B. I mean, a little bit, but, you know, I mean, Big Daddy Kane, De La Soul, Public Enemy, Run DMC. I mean, I remember Run DMC's third album, Tougher Than Leather. I went to prep school, and you could not leave school grounds during the day. But, I mean, it's a huge campus. There's lots of exits. So we physically could do it, but if you were caught, it was a big deal. You know, so it's kind of like the thing, like, if you get caught, it's a big deal, but you probably won't get caught.
Yeah.
And I remember leaving school in my little Honda Prelude and drove to Skippy White's right near my dad's, like, park in a, you know, other way, you know, and like around the corner so dad won't come out and then, that's my son's car, what the hell, he's supposed to be at school, and bought Run DMC's third album the first day it was available, you know, and because I had to have it.
And you had a lot, you know, were able to do a lot of research early. You know, I grew up in the white suburbs. For me, rap started when Aerosmith and Run DMC got together. And I think a lot of people say it's, you know, Grandmaster Flash. A lot of people... how far back would you go when you say that hip-hop started?
69.
Talk to me about that.
I mean, like, Kool Herc came from Jamaica, moved to the Bronx, and he brought some of the traditions of DJing in Jamaica to the Bronx. Mm-hmm. He had a massive system. He was huge built, so that's why they called him Hercules or Herc, Kool Herc. And you know, he would spin his system, you know, blow out the whole neighborhood. And so he really begins it, and not just spinning, but also the thing of spinning a small part of the record so that there's a break, like on the break, mm-hmm. so that there's a specific intensity of dancing moment, because you know that there's either at the beginning or in the middle, there's the most intense part of a record a lot of times, and it's short, so he would get two copies and extend that moment, so then you have a great moment of intense dancing, you know, rather than a short moment. And he'd also talk over the records a little bit, you know, so that that's really the beginning of hip-hop. And then you get into 73 74, graffiti is involved, breakdance is codified, and like 74, 75, people are starting to rap in very sort of primitive, relatively primitive ways to now, but now we're starting to develop.
You've got a good radio voice. Did you ever want to rap?
No, never. It's funny you say that because, you know, I'm growing up in Boston.
Yeah.
looking at these guys in the 80s, the thought of rhyming never crossed my mind. This was another thing that New Yorkers did or had that, you know, I mean, New York was this city on a hill to me. My dad grew up in New York. My mom spent a lot of time there. So I heard in the house a lot of these stories of how great New York is before we had you kids, me and my little sister, before we had you kids. We used to hang out in New York, you know, and go downtown and uptown, and it was so great. Now we're stuck here with you kids. You know, but the rhyming was something that New Yorkers did, you know, another example of how great and epic New Yorkers are, you know. So It never, and I think if I was a teenager now, I wouldn't think of rhyming, but I would think of, there are so many other ways that you can get involved. You could be a mogul, you could be an agent, you could be, you know, some sort of a VJ or DJ, or, you know, there's so many other ways to be in hip hop. But at that point, I didn't see all that.
I ask partly because I think your writing style, I see it almost as a freestyle. I mean, you go into an interview and it seems like you don't have any preconceptions, like this is what I'm going to write about.
Yeah.
And I think that's a hallmark of your work. I mean, as you read through these articles, each one is written in a different style. And I think most journalists, if you were to read a group of their articles, you'd start to see patterns that I don't see with you. And yet, in your words, you were the worst intern Rolling Stone ever had.
No doubt.
You were fired, but before returning and writing features, I want you to talk a little bit about that. And I'm wondering if that event was a blow to your ego at the time.
No,
or did it fuel you? I mean,
neither. I mean, you know, when I was doing my college newspaper, I called Rolling Stone to get some piece of information. Somebody talked to me for a while, and I discovered they had an intern program. So I got in the program, started interning, and right away I realized this is not constructed for us to become writers. We're not even going to be given an opportunity to show what we can do or not do as writers. This is a free little slave labor force, you know. So I was like, okay, I need to use this opportunity, being up in this little space of Rolling Stone, to get some writing going. So I would go to the other interns and delegate to them. And, you know, the intern head, she wants you to sit at the desk and answer this phone for the next half hour. And for some reason, they always went along with it. I have no idea why, but they would. And that gave me a little time to go around to the writers and the editors. So how do you become a writer? What do you have to do? And then, so eventually I got fired for walking around the office. There's Chris Mundy, who's the big writer then, had given me a new album, just came out, and I'm walking around listening to it on my Walkman headphones, delivering the mail. And somebody didn't like that and, you know, complained. And I was already, you know, known as the bad intern, so I got fired. But it was never my intention or interest to be an intern, so it didn't affect me emotionally or confidence-wise, and I'd already made a little friend, and Anthony DeCurtis was the record review editor. He gave me a chance to write a little record review, and ever since then, they can't get rid of me.
I'm sure young people come up to you and ask you for advice on how to get started. Do you tell them to do it your way, or did that just work for you?
No, I mean, I remember in After Henry, Joan Didion has a piece where she talks about going to Quintana's school in first grade, her daughter, and saying she had no idea how she became a writer. And she also knew that they, nor anybody else, could walk in the same path and get to her end. And the same thing with me. I couldn't recreate that set of circumstances if I was 21 again. I don't think anyone else could. And, you know, the game is a lot different. There's a lot more places to go. I mean, a lot of kids, I tell them that you can get a lot of traction starting a blog. You can get a lot of people knowing who you are, caring about your opinion, showing your writing style. I think it's a little, in some ways, it's a little trickier to climb up now because there's so many more magazines.
Print versus broadcast. It seems like there would be some differences there, and you move back and forth constantly.
Yeah.
Do you find one more challenging?
Oh, yeah. Print is way more challenging. I'm sorry, but, like, my producer from CNN is here. But, I mean, yeah. You know, CNN is amazing, BET is fun, but it'd be like just, unless you're doing like a long package, just to talk on television, the discussion is so much less deep than it will be in print. You know, I mean, like, just the intellectual challenge of writing a cover story for Rolling Stone is a lot more than going on CNN and going, yeah, Kanye West is great, and da-da-da. And even me trying to make it intellectually complicated is still, you can't, versus 4,000 words of space to, like, really get down and, okay, like, let's understand Kanye and, you know, he's a spoiled brat because he's single parent, single mom, single child, and his mom spoiled him. And, I mean, and that's really real. I mean, I think you can feel that, right? That he's a spoiled child.
It's
not a diss. I said that to him. His mom agreed with me.
Hey, you say a lot of things in this book that could get you in trouble but end up getting you a pretty good interview. Suge Knight, Suge Knight's a record producer, Death Row Records, allegedly a gangster. I don't know. He's been convicted. I guess I can just say he's a gangster, you know.
I don't know if he's been convicted of being a gang member yet, but his affiliation to the Bloods is deep.
We'll go with allegedly. talk a little bit about that moment. I was hoping, you know, it's in the book, but if you could go back, if you want to.
Sure. No, it's a crazy story. I mean, I was doing a feature for The New Yorker about Dick Griffey, who was the scariest man in the record business in the 70s, even though he had bright, happy music, Solar Records. He launched Babyface and Jody Watley. And so it's happy music, but he's a scary motherfucker. Oh, we can't curse on the radio, can we? Can you bleep? Okay, good, good. So, you know, Dick took me over to Suge, because they still had a sort of friendship, and Dick felt that he had helped found Death Row, and he deserved 25%. And Suge felt, no, you didn't get an initial quarter. And it was sort of a handshake deal in a room with three or four men. So who knew what really was truth, you know? But at that point, you know, it's eight figures that we're arguing over, you know? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's a huge thing. But they could still call each other and talk, because there was a very father-son mentor relationship thing. So Dick takes me over to Death Row. Suge is showing me around his office. There's the blood red couch, and, you know, there's this little bed, and there's like a wall of television so he can see, you know, everything that's going on in every inch of Death Row. And there's the piranha tank in the back, and there was this other little door in the back that he didn't acknowledge at all. And I was like, okay, it could be a closet, but it could be, you know, who knows. So Dick left, and Suge and I started to talk, and, you know, we're talking about his past with Dick and yada yada, and it's all sweet. And I'm starting to feel really comfortable with Dick Griffey, with Suge Knight, which is kind of like starting to feel comfortable with the devil, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I was like, and Dick was suing Suge. That was the half of the point while I was there. So I was like, you know, what's up with the lawsuit, you know? And I try to just, you know, ask things very casually, you know. I remember I interviewed Omira, the beautiful Dominican model, and she's talking about getting married at 15, and I was like, so, you know, when did you lose your virginity? Mm-hmm. You know, and she had this look like, oh, how did you ask me that? But I'm just asking it very casually, like, you know, what did you do this morning? You know, when did you lose your virginity?
One more scene setter. You're not a small guy. You're in good shape. But Suge Knight.
No, so I'm going back. So I'm like, you know, so what's up with the lawsuit, you know? And he's like, you know, I ain't talking about that. He said, I don't know what you're talking about. And I was feeling really comfortable. I was like, come on, man. You know what I'm talking about. That was really the end of it there. Because then he's like, shut off your tape recorder. The guy is 6'4", 310. He was a linebacker at UNLV. I mean, he's a huge guy. And he's like, turn off your tape recorder. I'm like, oh, man. And then he's like, stand up. I'm like, oh, what's this happening? And then he kind of like puts his arm over my shoulder, like to here. And he's like moving me across the room. And I'm not really wanting to go with him.
Yeah.
But he's kind of dragging me. And we're going over toward the piranha tank and toward the little room.
Yeah.
And I'm like, is this a little torture room? Like, I don't know what's about to happen.
Are you looking for plastic on the ground?
I'm wondering what's about to happen. And you know, and I'm thinking, you know, if I only get punched once, that's okay. Like, that's my par for the night right now. So he's like, you burned your bridge with Death Row, and you don't come up in here, ask about lawsuits. I'm like, yes, no, sir, yes, whatever you say. So then when he finishes grabbing me, I start walking for the door. Like, I'm out of here. And he's like, where are you going? Sit back down. I'm like, oh, this isn't over? Yeah. So then he goes to the door, and he calls to somebody, and a young man who was clearly a blood, like, clearly in it, like, bandana. I think there was a teardrop. Like, he was real.
No allegedly.
No alleged out of this brother. Okay. And so Shug is like, you know, this nigga want to talk about lawsuits. And the kid, you know, this is a kid who's like, you know, what do you need me to do? You want me to kill somebody? You want me to stab somebody? You want me to rob, like, steal a car? Whatever you want me to do, I'm down. You know, so he's like, oh, word? Beat up the little suburban kid? No problem. Let's go. And so he keeps, like, you know, like, jumping. Like, he's going to rush me. And Shug keeps like, no. So then finally he sends the kid away. You know, completely terrorized and traumatized and victimized. And Shug sits down. And in the back of my mind, I'm like, okay, well, I still have this interview. And then he says, press rewind. Let's go back to the beginning of the tapes. I'm like, oh, now I'm losing my interview. I'm walking out of here with nothing. So then we get to the beginning, and he says, okay, press record. And I'm like, all right. And then he gave me the interview again, 45 minutes, total recall, telling all the stories and anecdotes in the exact same order without re-prompting from me. Total recall. Until we got to the point where I asked him about the lawsuit, and he's like, okay, that's it. I get out. And I kind of, like, ran out.
How'd you handle that as a journalist? I mean, where do you go from there? I mean...
The biggest problem was that it was a feature. It was my first feature for the New Yorker, and they ended up not taking it. So after all that, risking my life, I spent like a month in L.A., missed my then girlfriend's birthday, like, and it didn't get published. You know, I mean, like, the writer has the last laugh. You know, as you know, you publish it. You know, so. To get to be able to, I mean, I published it years later in a smaller magazine. To get to be able to put it out here is finally, like, you know, delicious revenge, perhaps.
Yeah. Have you heard from Shug since it was published?
No, I haven't. I mean, he's got much larger problems to deal with right now. So, I mean, I think there's a freeze on his millions. He's got like $105 million frozen by some judge right now. Yeah. So... he's got bigger fish to fry before he gets to me. But I saw him on Sunset Boulevard once. I was driving in some little rental car, and he was in some big SUV. And we were, like, parallel for, like, a good 3-4 minutes. And I knew he wouldn't notice me or anything. But it definitely occurred to me, like, what if I do one of those, like, movie things, like, kind of, like, you know, do a quick swerve so he has to kind of do some weird thing, and then maybe he gets into an accident, and too bad.
Or just roll down the window and say, what about the lawsuit?
Yeah. That would have been great.
Read the piece, by the way, because...
The Shug thing?
I'm telling the audience, because the Dick Riffey, fascinating character, you talk to a lot of interesting people, and I think... one thing that's pretty consistent is you talk to a lot of artists right when they're interesting.
Yeah.
Beginning of their careers, 50 Cent.
This is the Mission Impossible thing of Rolling Stone. I mean, it's the most exciting thing. Right when, you know, D'Angelo or 50 or Eminem is at their heat and everybody in the street is like, what's up with this? What's up with that? You know, Eminem, 50 Cent, D'Angelo, whoever. Then the phone rings and Rolling Stone's like, let's break down D'Angelo. Let's get into Lauryn Hill. Like, whatever. And I'm like, yes. Like, right when it's hot. That's the beauty of Rolling Stone for me.
Yeah, and I think your Lauryn Hill interview, you caught her. I think if you interviewed her now, it would be a lot less interesting. Is that a Rolling Stone thing? Is that a Touré thing? Just in terms of, I mean, do you feel like timing is really important to your writing?
I mean, magazines get into the thing of wanting to be first, and I think that that's kind of silly and overthought, and we want to be before Spin and Vibe, and I don't think the audience really cares. I mean, if you're interested in Jay-Z and he's been in Vibe, you're still going to read my story in Rolling Stone if you're that interested in him. I don't think you're saying, well, I read the Vibe story, so I'm bored now. But, I mean, for me, Like, I enjoy very much being a cultural senator, that my people, you know, in the neighborhood or out, you know, anywhere in the country are, you know, people who love hip-hop are talking about D'Angelo or Eminem, and they're saying, what's up with this or what's going on with that? Or, and I come and I get to talk for them and say, so, the community is wondering such and such, you know. Mm-hmm. Like, I just interviewed Dave Chappelle for BET. Mm-hmm. And, you know, toward the end, and, you know, it's definitely one of those toward the end sort of questions. I was like, so, you know, I saw you on Oprah, saw you on James Lipton. I still don't know why you left your show. And he said, did Viacom make you ask that? I'm like, no, dude. The fucking community. I'm sorry, again, with the cursing.
That's all right. They're going to beep it out.
Brooklyn made me ask you. I mean, all of Brooklyn, and I'm sure the people in San Francisco who still care about him, the whole country who still cares about him, is like, why did you leave? You know, and that's what I enjoy. Everybody is saying, why did you leave Dave Chappelle? You know, or D'Angelo, why did you leave? Lauren, why did you leave? Eminem, why are you on the mic? Whatever. 50 Cent, you know, why were you dealing crack? You know, and why did you attack Ja Rule? All those. And I get to get up in their face and be like, so, what's up? Look, she's ascending the stage.
A lot of tough questions, I hope we've got some questions for you, I understand, and hope they're equally tough.
Lots of questions from the audience. Starting with, one of our audience members wants clarification of the title of your book. The audience member says, Never Drank the Kool-Aid made me think of Jim Jones and Guyana. What is the meaning of the title?
Can just the person write the question, just raise your hand so I know who I'm talking to? Thank you. It's a piece of slang from Jonestown, that thing of, I mean, drinking, it's really drink the Kool-Aid. You drank the Kool-Aid. You know, you are following so-and-so's philosophy almost blindly, you know. So I'm saying, you know, I'm not following these people's philosophy. I mean, you know, if you have enough charisma that you can stand on a stage and make, you know, 5,000 people scream your name, when you're one-on-one with that person, they can seduce you without really even trying, you know. And it takes a lot to be like, you know, I'm not going to be seduced by you. I'm going to see you for who you are. And I want to feel some of what the fan feels, because I'm writing partly for the fans. But I also want to be able to be critical, you know, and see what's really there. Not just what I want to see or what I expected going in, but what's really shown to me.
So it implies a skepticism.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, here we go. Another question. The likes of Mos Def and Dead Prez have been politically vocal about current events and problems that our country is experiencing. Do you think that they are effectively reaching out to their target audience?
Dead Prez and
Mos Def.
Are they effectively reaching out to their... Whose question?
With their political statements.
Whose question is that? Just so I know. Oh, hi. Yeah, absolutely. They are. I mean, for their fans, absolutely. You know, and politically astute brothers, absolutely. Now, in general, hip-hop has kind of lost its political spine, you know. I mean, we spend so much time talking truth to power and tell, you know, we would be the ones who tell the country, you know, the emperor's naked, you know. And, you know, it's such a politicized moment. I felt like during Clinton, especially the last half of Clinton, it was not a politicized moment. So I was kind of like, why would it exist in the music? But now it is, between Iraq, Iran, immigration, Katrina. Especially Katrina is so deep and such an open wound for black people. And there have been a couple of songs. Mos Def had an awesome Katrina response song. It really just is amazing. But for the most part, we're not talking about those important issues. So, I mean, those guys are kind of existing on an island, you know.
Here's a good San Francisco question.
Okay.
Have you written about the East Coast-West Coast rivalry? If not, why not? If so, do you think that it helped clarify the issue or dispel any misconceptions? East Coast-West Coast hip-hop rivalry.
Yeah. No, I did not write about that. I also think that term is misleading. It was not the East Coast and the West Coast. Naughty by Nature was not involved. De La Soul was not involved. You know, the Far Side was not involved. This was Suge and Tupac. I mean, and Snoop wasn't even really involved. It was Suge and Tupac woofing at Puffy and Biggie. And Puffy and Biggie were kind of like, how did we get here? We don't want to be involved. We're not making records back at you guys. You know, when we go on the radio, we're like, you know, we love everybody. You know, we're not attacking. And, you know, I was at the Source Awards when it kind of started, when Suge got on stage and said, you know, if you want to, you know, have a career where your manager is not in the video dancing all over the place, then come to Death Row. And it was, you know, very bold move. You know, in New York City, he was booed. You know, he's the sort of guy who's like, I don't care if y'all boo me. So I felt like the whole thing was, you know, was misunderstood to call it East-West. It was not coast versus coast. And, yeah, for the most part, I didn't write about it. I just didn't have, the opportunity to write about those figures at that time. I think I did something on Puff around then. But, you know, they weren't focused on that. They were focused on other things. They're trying to make money and get out of it, you know. This wasn't like the Jay-Z Nas battle, you know, or the Game 50 battle now, where they are going back and forth. And there's actually a really incredible record that the Game made dissing 50. And at the and there's these white boys who sort of narrate the record. And at the end of it, one of the white boys says, and Game told me that I'm the only white boy in the world who would call you a nigger. And then Game comes on and he says, I approve that. And I'm like, wow, like we're getting like this. So this is a really, that's a really nasty beef. So.
Well, just to follow up, I mean, New York, L.A. is where I think of where the rap beefs are. But looking at the Oscars, 3-6 Mafia, the, you know, Crunk from the South, here nearby in Oakland, the hyphy movement, E-40 and Keek to Sneak, they're getting a lot of traction with this new sound they've got. And I'm wondering if as rap starts spreading out a little bit more, if maybe that's a good thing.
Absolutely a good thing. I mean, you know, it's fabulous for the whole country to speak, you know. And I was in Portland yesterday. There's some guys up there, you know, that take hip-hop really seriously. Seattle as well. I mean, the Pacific Northwest hasn't really had their moment. You know, just to broaden the discussion of, you know, what we're talking about. And to me, the next level of really broadening discussions on two levels, the international group has to speak. There's got to be a kid in Tokyo who speaks perfect English, who can rhyme really fast, really well. I mean, I know, and he's going to come up, and I know there are people, young men in Tokyo, with dreams of blowing up in America. So, like, that guy's got to come. San Juan's got to speak. You know, they got to come up. They speak English. You know, they got to have their moment. Where is London? London has had such an impact on soul music and on rock and roll, but almost no impact on hip-hop. So they've got a, you know, and Brixton is, you know, a neighborhood that we would respect as Americans, so they've got to step up. But I also want to see more women step up in a way that is speaking about them and their communities. I think most, with the exception of, say, Latifah and Lauren, almost all, or pretty much all the female rappers are either tomboys or boy toys. Lil Kim being the classic sort of boy toy, you know, Missy and MC Light being your sort of tomboys. You know, they have a very masculine edge to them. They talk like men. There's more black women in America than black men, especially in the hood. Why aren't they talking about their issues? I mean, you know, Alicia did it in her first video where she's talking about her man is in jail, but she still loves him. And that's a really deep, very real, very hip-hop message. Where's the rap song expressing that from a sister in the community? So that's what I'm looking forward to.
A number of questions here about gangster rap, and basically they boil down to what do you see as its future?
You know, I don't make that distinction of this is gangster rap and this is not. And, you know, I mean, you know, for a guy to talk about, you know, guns or shooting somebody or dealing is, you know, I mean, he's talking about his life or at least the life that he's seen around him. You know, and a lot of guys do both things. I mean, 50 Cent was all about, you know, what you would call gangster rap, but now he's making a lot of love songs and, you know, like on Streets Disciple, Nas's great double album, his last album. You know, he's got one song talking about the drug world and the next song talking about his relationship with his dad, you know, and how much he misses his mom who's passed away. So, you know, it's not, to me, it's not, but I mean, for the most part, that moment has passed. You know, I mean, that is not really the dominant mode of expression now, talking about drugs, street, guns.
Here's one to make you think. Of the people you've interviewed, whose personality surprised you most or differed most from public perception?
Whose question is that? Somebody claim it.
You're not owning up.
Somebody, nobody? Okay. Sandra Bernhardt was very early in my career, which this was what taught me to not go into it with expectations. She did a sort of funny rock sort of album. Rolling Stone asked me to do a story on her. And I expected the David Letterman character, because remember, she used to go on Letterman and smoke and be this sort of almost lesbian person, very out, very, you know, oh, Dave, you're so crazy, you know. And it's just huge personality. And that's a stage personality. You know, I mean, it's real, but that's for the stage, you know. So when we sat down, she was like, hi, how are you? What's up? And I'm like totally thrown off, you know. And then we kind of got into this weird thing because I'm not gay. I've never been gay. I've never been confused about that. But I've always been comfortable talking about homosexuality and homosociality and homophobia. And so I felt like it was an appropriate question for her. Like, so to young gay people, you know, who are confused or thinking about things, you know, what would you say to them? You know, and I'm thinking third person, you know, for some of the readers. And she's like, well, what you need to think about. And I'm like, no, this isn't for me. But it's like, you know, you doth protest too much. Like, you know, oh, sure, it's not for you, skig. I'll see you in the club in a couple of years. You let me know how that works. Like.
Audience question. Do you have any comments about the three other aspects of hip-hop culture, graffiti, breakdancing, and
DJing.
DJing.
Yeah,
DJing.
I mean, going in chronological order, graffiti art is an extraordinarily important, valuable, amazing, creative form. I was not fortunate enough to live in New York when people would actually do it on trains. You know, that was amazing. But graffiti art has really lost its place in America. It's really more in Germany and in France, I think in England a little bit now. They take it much more seriously than we do. I saw some amazing pieces in Frankfurt 10 years ago. Second, DJing. You know, now we're in the age of the producer. So the person who we would have thought of as a DJ has become the producer. And the producer is really a dominant figure now. I mean, if you don't have a song by Pharrell or Just Blaze or Scott Storch or Ninth Wonder or Dr. Dre, it becomes kind of tricky to get on the radio, you know. And so they have a tremendous amount of control over the industry. But that classic sort of DJing thing has gone out. But I also, you know, I love a nice break, but, you know, when they get into all the DJ tricks with their turning around and spin behind, I'm like, oh, God, just play the music, man. Like, come on. Like, I know you can spin under your leg and, like, you know, it doesn't do anything for me, music. I can't dance to that, you know.
Breakdancing.
Yeah, I mean, breakdancing is really kind of dead in America. I mean, it didn't really evolve from that initial sort of style and way of doing it. And, you know, I mean, it's beautiful. I love to see it, but it's not. Again, something that's taken much more seriously in Europe now.
Here's one. When did you lose your virginity?
Hey, whose question is that? Come on, tell me. Good girl. I was 19 in college.
Ooh. Is that it?
She asked me when. I answered the question. You want me to give the whole story of the first woman I slept with?
What music was playing?
No music was playing. We were in England. She was 10 years older than me.
Oh.
It was a psychology trip that it was a psychology class.
Yeah.
I was after freshman year. It was people of all different classes, and she was the TA. The professor was with her husband most of the time. She was like the only person who was like 29 who was around, and she was cute, and I kept chatting her up. And at that point, I was a really sort of aggressive flirter, I didn't even think that she would give me any rhythm, but I was like, I kept just flirting with her, just throwing little things at her just to be interesting. And then finally she's like, well, if you want to stay. And I was like, sure. It was actually kind of crazy because she's like, do you want to stay the night? And I was like, yeah. And she's sitting on the bed and I'm sitting in a chair, and she's like, well, you're going to need to come over here.
Here's to you, Mrs. Robinson.
Just
to be clear, now you're married. You got married last year.
I've been married a year and a week.
And who officiated your wedding?
Reverend Run.
That is so cool.
He was, I've known him for a while. That was my first Rolling Stone feature. I've seen him around through different, through his different ups and downs. He was broke for a while, then he found God. He's on trial for rape, So I've been knowing him and Russell, his brother, for a while. And,
that's Russell Simmons.
Very famous
producer.
Couple of questions about comments appreciating your work on, CNN, and wondering if you're ever going back. And I think there's an implicit sort of curiosity about the culture at CNN.
It's too bad Casey left. Am I going back? No. I was asked to leave, so, my job was eliminated. So, no, won't be going back, at least not until the hierarchy is removed. But the culture is interesting. It's a little bit like being in the military. It's very – no, but I don't mean that in a bad way. I mean, it's very regimented. I mean, like, if you're going to be – if they tell you you're going to be on the air tomorrow at 9:14, you can set your watch, by that. Everybody is very – professional for the most part. It's very corporate. They use words like efforting. Drives me nuts. Efforting is not a word, it was very interesting. What I did was kind of looked down upon, I'm doing entertainment, somebody actually said to me, when the Pope was near death, it was all about the Pope that whole week, and one of the producers said to me, well, we won't be doing any frivolous stuff this week, so you can go home. Like, frivolous? Really? Like, I don't think so. I think the audience thinks it's interesting, though.
And VET? As a contrast?
It's a lot different. It's not like the military. It's a lot more... It feels a lot like being a black college. People are dressed up. It's kind of a fashion show. You walk down the hall and, everybody's got to say hi. I don't know if you know, but like black people, if you walk past a black person, you don't say hello, especially in a college atmosphere, you're done. They hate you. You have to say at least hello. I saw you in the yard this morning. You didn't speak, right? Like, people are like, oh, he's through. He's a sellout. He's an Oreo. I just didn't see you, man. I'm nearsighted. I'm sorry, But it's like that. It takes me 10 minutes to get down the hall because everyone's like, yo, what's up? What's going on? And they just want to say hi. Didn't have nothing to say. Didn't I see you yesterday? I did, and that was one. When I was working at MTV before CNN, I was not on the air. I was a writer for MTV News, but I noticed that then. That was the first time I'd had an office job, and when white people come in the morning, they don't say anything. They don't acknowledge you. If they see their best friend, they might speak to him or her, but. They don't, but black people come in and it's like, hey, like you're running for mayor. Hey. You got to at least speak,
Here's an audience member who wants to know, what do you think of groups like Gravediggers? Where do they fit into the mix?
Who asked about the Grave? You even remember the Gravediggers? That was horrorcore, right? Yeah, the Gravediggers was a construction, was, like, you know, like in sync, like Destiny's Child was put together. You know, there was nothing organic about the group or about their message, about what they wanted to say. It was, you know, a focus group sort of thing. Like, if we combine the tropes of, you know, horror movies and rap, we might have something. But it, you know, it wasn't real. I mean, hip hop is aspirational. So we want, as audience members in hip hop, we want to dream of being that person. You know, we want to be powerful. We want to be rich. And, you know, being half dead is not something that's aspirational. You know.
Is there one question you inevitably ask in every interview?
No. And a lot of times, you know, I'll have a list of questions, but then, you know, I want to follow the flow of the conversation. I mean, I want to ask a question that I didn't have any idea coming into it that I would ask or that I would know. I mean, for example, just hanging around Beyonce for a couple of days, you know, and just listening, just being open to her and this little short assistant, Angela, who's her friend and keeps talking to her. And I kind of looked and I was like, you have Beyonce tattooed on your leg. What's up with that? No, that's not her name. That's my name. Her name is Angela Beyonce. She's her cousin. Beyonce is her maternal family name. She's from her family's, well, that side of the family is Creole, from New Orleans. So Beyonce is her family name. And I think 100 profiles have been written and nobody had figured that out because nobody would ever think to ask that. And nobody paid attention to Angela to see that. And so I went in there. That was certainly not on the list of questions I had. But then I found that out, and then I get in there, and then it's something to talk about with her mom, you know, and her mom had a funny story about her father was like, what are you doing naming her Beyonce? That's the last name. She's like, Dad, this is the last name to us, not to anybody else, so.
Well, in that vein, what about Toure?
What about it?
The name.
Tell us. Toure is a last name, a family name in Africa. It's sort of like Kennedys or royal-ish to them, so when I go to Africa, they're like, silly American, that's not a first name. It was the name that my mother gave me when I was born. It's not a pen name. You know, when I got to college, I mean, my father's father died before he was born, you know. So we don't really have a direct connection. I mean, you probably have stories about your grandfather or your great-grandmother, which give the name Lane some meaning. You know, we lived here. We moved to San Francisco, you know, in the 1850s or whatever it is. We don't have any of that. My family doesn't have any of that. A lot of African-American families don't have any of that. So the last name, the government name, was just something that was there but didn't have meaning for us, didn't, you know, there's not knowledge and history behind it, you know, something that's automatic, you know, and I didn't want that. I wanted the thing that my parents had consciously chosen that had meaning for us.
You touched on blogging. Here's a question from the audience. How important is blogging as a newer medium for publishing short stories, interviews, and album reviews? Does its anonymous nature and easy access discredit its legitimacy?
Well, a lot of the blogging I've seen is not anonymous. I mean, I read about 40, maybe 60 blogs a day. And it can be a great form, although it has to be short. You know, I mean, a long posting is a little difficult to deal with, you know, but like a good short post, you know, I mean, I love the blogs. It's just a way of disseminating information and opinions. And, you know, it's a fabulous new ultra democratic wing of the media.
Someone asked you earlier, or you mentioned that's a way for somebody sort of to establish themselves,
yeah,
as opposed to, say, an internship at Rolling Stone.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, if you intern at Rolling Stone, you probably won't be given a chance to write unless you try really, really hard. But, you know, if you want to be in the music game, you start doing a music blog, people start talking about it. It's like, oh, my God, you know, Nate's blog is really consistently good, you know, and you know, then somebody go, oh, okay. I mean, you know, if you walk in a magazine with no bylines to your name, it's very hard to convince them to give you a byline. But, you know, so you have to You know, so it's the whole, you know, job experience. Well, you can't get a job without experience, and that chicken and egg thing. And a blog is a way that you can just bum rush the system.
Well, Touré, the book is Never Drank the Kool-Aid. Thank you so much for being with us here at the Commonwealth Club tonight. Thanks to Peter Hartlaub. Thanks to you in the audience and our audience on the radio. And for the Commonwealth Club, I'm Barbara Lane. Good night.
Thank you, guys.
Good evening. I'm Barbara Lane. Welcome to Good Lit at the Commonwealth Club and this evening's program with Touré. The program is co-sponsored by Inforum, the Commonwealth Club's division for people in their 20s and 30s. Interviewing Touré tonight is the San Francisco Chronicle's pop